Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. We're so glad to have you with us here this evening on Ask Herbal Health Expert Susan Weed, a two-hour radio show each Tuesday night. Herbal medicine is people's medicine, simple, safe, effective. Please bring your curiosity and health questions. Susan will enlighten, surprise, and delight you. I know most of you know Susan Weed already. She's my mom, so I know her. But for those of you who have not yet met Susan, I'd like to share. She is the author of the Wise Woman Herbal series, wonderful books on women's health and herbal medicine, including Wise Woman Herbal for the Childbearing Year, Breast Cancer, Breast Health! The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Wise Woman Herbal, New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way.
And Abundantly Well, Seven Medicines, The Wise Woman Way, the newest book in the Wise Woman Herbal series.
So exciting.
In addition to being the editor at Ash Tree Publishing and writing her books, Susan is the director of the Wise Woman Center in Woodstock, New York. The Wise Woman Center is open to the public on appointment-only basis. She offers weekend workshops, intensives, and apprenticeships throughout the season. Susan is also available to you online via wisewomanmentor.com. There you can go and view her weekly e-zine. You can subscribe to receive a notification via email each week, or you could join her mentorship program. Susan also offers distance learning correspondence courses and online courses.
TheWiseWomanSchool.com. Join us there for colorful, instructive, easy video courses, including Easy Herbal Medicine with Susan Weed, Happy Knees, a cancer diagnosis, adaptogens for long life, and Abundantly Well companion course, wisewomanschool.com.
You can also just go to her website, susanweed.com, where you will find thousands of pages online with recipes, articles, art features, and so much more. Well, for now, let's see what Susan has to share with us this evening. Thank you, and welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Justine, and welcome, Sarah Ellen.
Hi, Susan. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, enjoying another beautiful day in the Catskills. We finally had just the rain that we needed, and it seems like every hour it's greener.
Oh, how marvelous.
It really is. I transplanted all the tomatoes out today. And the squash seedlings and the morning glory seedlings. Some of those morning glory seedlings got a little frosty when it went down to 36 last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they were the only thing. I covered everything, but the cover must have, like, touched them. And they were just, you know, in cotyledons, they didn't have any true leaves yet. And they were like, oh, and the cotyledons turned brown. And it's like, whoa. And some of them, I think that's it. But others of them, the first true leaf is pushing up.
Oh, wow, interesting. It's such a,
yeah.
So delicate, and Yeah. I'm glad we're going to make it.
Yeah, that last little nip there mid-May, which the cats are so fond of. I've actually seen it snow on Mother's Day.
I was just thinking here, it's like you can almost count on Mother's Day getting some flurries at least. And, yep.
So. So don't push it, even though all that early May weather seems so nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And getting ready to go off to the Midwest Women's Herbal Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
Where I will be joined with a host of others. I was talking about this last year when it was really coming back from the COVID years and being back in community. And I love to be at the herbal conferences. I love to teach at the herbal conferences. I love that there are herbal conferences.
Yes. Yes. So much fun. And so many people.
Yeah. Just such connections and interactions and, just the agora, the marketplace, the place where the people come out of their houses and are together.
Mm.
As we were asked to seclude and seclude and seclude yet again during the COVID years, they said, oh, agoraphobia, which always lurks, right? The fear of being in the public.
Right.
Right? I said, oh, dear, you know, here it's being very fed by this.
Mm. Yeah.
Especially when you think, you know, that human civilization used to require that almost everyone go to the marketplace, go to the agora on a daily basis.
Mm.
Which is one of the reasons why the witch, the wise woman, was suspect. Because she could live from what the earth gave her.
Mm. Interesting.
Right?
Makes sense.
Well, you think about it, you know. I'm eating cooked greens, garlic mustard.
Yum.
And various greens in my salad a full month before anybody's getting that out of their garden.
Mm-hmm. So true.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah. And let's see, after the Midwest Women's Herbal Conference, I'll be teaching here at the Wise Woman Center. And then I will be off to the International Herb Symposium.
Wow, you're busy, busy,
busy. Busy, busy, busy. Astrid Grove, who presented both at the Comfrey Conference and at the Hypericum Conference, and who also apprenticed with me, and was an intern here for a year. We've been in touch for the 25, 26 years since she was an apprentice, is coming in, and we're going to go together to the International Herb Symposium. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Oh, wow. She's going to go to your place from Colorado, and then you'll head
from
up
Colorado,
there.
And then in September, I'm going to go out to Colorado and teach at her Red Earth Gathering.
Aww. Wow.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. Yeah.
Ta-da. Ah, all the gatherings, and especially the beautiful gatherings of the Green Hearts.
Mm.
Mm.
So happy there. So
yeah.
Much so.
I always really appreciated Pam Montgomery's Green Nations gatherings.
Mm. I never got to go to one of those. When did she have those?
Actually, it's kind of interesting. I got somehow a flyer in the mail that said there was an herbalist gathering at Brighton Bush Hot Springs. And I thought, oh, isn't that lovely, but I'm not an herbalist, I can't go, and I threw it away. Mm. Not just I'm not an herbalist, but also just think how much money that would be, Susan, to get a plane ticket to the West Coast and to pay for this and all of that. You'll never have the money. At that time, this was obviously quite a long time ago, it was around $500 to pay for the event, pay for my transportation, all of that. And I thought, you don't have $500. You don't have $500 extra. So I threw it away. And within the week, a local restaurant called me and asked if I would provide them with wild food for their wild food menu for 10 weeks for $50 a week.
I think you were supposed to be in Brighton Bush.
I dug it out of the trash. I mean, I got it. So I came home from there really just totally thrilled to have spent time with so many herbalists and totally upset, as I said to Pam Montgomery, who was apprenticing with me at the time. They think there aren't any herbalists on the East Coast.
Oh.
And Pam, wonderful Pam, took that, you know, as a impetus to start having East Coast herb gatherings, which she called Green Nations.
Mm.
And they got bigger and bigger. Oh, really extraordinary gatherings.
Mm.
She has written a couple of wonderful books and is spending a lot of time talking with plants. She's gone to, the name is slipping my mind right now, but I'll probably think of it later, a place in Italy where they have like an electronic device to help you hear what plants are saying.
Yes, it's I've been with
right? It's not words.
That.
It's like,
yeah. That's so amazing. What?
It is. At one of the last Green Nations gatherings that she had this device, and she had it on a tulsi plant, a holy basil plant, and she let people from the audience come up to the plant, and the plant totally changed its tune.
Whoa, depending on who was up with it?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. How fun. Wow.
Yeah. And what about you? What's happening at your place?
Oh, well, we are busy in the garden. I've been spending a lot of time out there and just tending to the things that we planted and finding still like new patches of things that are growing wild and encouraging those along, but really been pretty active in the garden planting and then moving mulch around from trees that had fallen last year and were turned into mulch. And so a lot of time outside for sure. And it's been hot lately. Today it like spiked up to the mid 80s, and now tomorrow we're going all the way down to the 50s, and the high is only 70. So, still
wow.
Interesting weather. Yeah. Yeah. So tomorrow will be a good day to be outside for longer than today, because I was outside a lot today, but it was definitely, it was pretty roasting out there.
Yeah. We had a really great work exchange weekend, and we brought all the plants outside. And I repotted those that needed to be repotted, or at least the ones that most desperately needed to be repotted. And it was really something, you know, really, you know, like lifting all those pretty heavy pots. There's some big plants out there. And I wrote a little thing for the easy, and I said, as I near 80, I appreciate more and more those who come to help me do this heavy work.
Aww.
So, yes, my thanks to all of those extra hands, so that I am spared every single pound of it. So a lot of pounds of the stuff. What was not heavy at all was wrapping up the Hypericum conference. Justine videoed me today in my Hypericum t-shirt. I know you haven't gotten yours. I just went and nudged Mick about getting me the thing so that I can address them before I go away. So, that you get to see it at least on the video, which I wrap up the Hypericum conference and say that I found it harder to end the nonsense than I did to end the fear, and that so far as I could add, it was about 800 years of clinical experience, not just personal experience, but clinical experience with other people represented at the conference, or about 50 hours of actual instruction time over the course of the 10 days of the Hypericum conference. And I said, wow, you know, this is probably the richest, densest, most amazing course that I had put out for the money, $100 for 50 hours.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah.
Yes. There's so much in there. So much.
There's just so much, even watching it day by day, which was a commitment. And I didn't have to watch it all because I read. So, you know, there was a certain amount every day that I said, okay, I don't have to watch that. I did it. But the readings are quite to the point. I had a really, really huge field to choose from in choosing what readings to do. And I said that one of the biggest nonsenses around Hypericum is that it causes photosensitivity, and so it can't be used. And that today I was actually putting hyaluronic acid cream on my face, and there's a warning right there on the jar that says, warning, this could cause you to be sun sensitive. And so I went to my computer and I asked, are there any drugs that make me sun sensitive? And I got a whole list of them.
Right.
So even if it did make you sun sensitive, so what? It's not like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. And over the 800 years of experience, there were 4 possible incidences of sun sensitivity.
Right.
All of which, as I recall, were completely remedied by withdrawal or reduction of the Hypericum.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your recollection?
It is. Yep, yep. Yeah.
And yet, you know, those who experienced those possible sun sensitivities, even if it wasn't them, but it was a patient of theirs, seemed to be the ones who were really clinging to the fact that it was dangerous to use in that way.
Right.
Whereas certainly most of the presenters were feeling very much at ease with it. And I also mentioned, of course, that I had not had anybody to see a drug interaction, and that even extended to, and I didn't know how many people caught what Dr. Dillard was saying. Did we talk about this yet? Dr. Dillard's short?
No.
What?
No, I knew it.
Dr. Dillard's short. He's throwing a pot. He's at his pottery wheel. And he's an osteopath. And he talks about how his daughter, Astrid, turned him on to Hypericum as an antiviral, especially against herpes, and how very effective he found it for his patients. And then he then started trying it for other kinds of viral infections. And then Astrid taught him about elderberry. And he combined the Hypericum with the elderberry and thought, now I have two good antivirals. And then he said it struck him that when you make a combination, it's supposed to be three. And so he added a cyclovir.
He added what?
A cyclovir.
Okay. Is that a drug? What is that?
That is a drug. It's an antiviral drug.
Ah.
It's a frequently prescribed antiviral drug. And he says, right? He says, and he just, you know, he just says this like, da-da-da-da-da-da, not, and I thought, I wonder if it would be okay if I combined, he just said, and I thought a third thing, oh, a cyclovir, and I've been using the combination of these three things with great success for quite a while.
How fascinating. So obviously he's not worried about a drug interaction. He thinks that it works well in combination with the drug.
Yes.
That's awesome. Wow.
So we have 800 years, 22 presenters, and no drug interactions, plus an osteopath who purposely uses it with an antiviral drug and gets good results. As well as tons and tons and tons of anecdotal evidence of it being safe to use. I said in the wrap-up, I said, you know, if you're taking a drug, like an anti-rejection drug, that your life actually depends on getting the right amount of that drug at the right time, then I'd probably be excessively careful. Other than that, I wouldn't worry.
Yeah.
And excessively careful doesn't even mean not to take it.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the books that I read talks about the half-life of the different constituents of Hypericum. And so knowing that and knowing the half-life of the drugs that you're taking, it should be possible to take them concurrently, although maybe not at exactly the same time. Someone who knows about half-lives and interactions would be able to figure it out. That's not me, but somebody else could do it.
Right. I would think there'd be ways if you wanted to incorporate Hypericum, but then they could probably measure it.
Especially if you were feeling horribly depressed, if you'd had like an organ transplant and you were feeling depressed. That would be like a possibility.
Right.
The story I used to tell was that a MD, who was a heart surgeon, decided that since depression often followed heart surgery, that he would give his patients Hypericum, and that it made their drugs not work and they died. Now, I'm not sure where I heard that story. And I, at this point, certainly don't think that this story is true. But it's interesting what a well of nonsense there is out there.
Wow.
And how easy it is for any and all of us to add to it. Our guest tonight tackles this issue in a really deep way. Her name is Kylea Taylor, and she's a licensed therapist who's been working with Stanislav and Christina Groff since the early 1980s. And not only works with holotropic breathwork and psychedelic sessions, but her real focus is ethics. She's developed and teaches a self-reflective, self-compassionate approach to relational ethics. Come back at 9 o'clock to hear Kylea Taylor, or stick with us until then. Anything else going on that you want to talk about?
Oh, no. I think that's it for me. I see lots of, well, three hands have already gone up, so.
All right. Let's jump into the questions.
All right. I'll remind everyone, if you have a question this evening, please do press 1. So that we can see your hand go up in the queue. So if you've got a question, press the number 1, and that will get your hand raised in the queue. We have 3 callers that have raised their hands already. The first is dialed in from the 707 area code. From the 707, you are live with Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi, this is Manzanita. I had a question about red clover. I use infusions, drink them regularly, and I was wondering about the time in my cycle that would be the most beneficial to use red clover for the estrogen, or if you have opinions about that. That's my question.
That's a question.
For fertility,
a question that doesn't have enough information. In other words, you don't know enough about estrogen.
Right.
So let's talk about estrogen. Yeah. First of all, human women make 30 different kinds of estrogen.
Right.
And we start making those estrogens before we're born.
Yeah.
So what part of your cycle is the best part of your cycle for estrogen?
That's where I'm unclear. I was going to do some research.
That's an absurd question, isn't it?
Yes.
It's completely absurd. Your body produces varying amounts of at least 29 different estrogens every day of your life from before you're born until the day you die.
Right.
There's no time in which you are not estrogen-rich, in which you do not have plenty of estrogen to do whatever you need. Red clover, like all legumes, right, like soybeans or anything in that family, and like all roots and like all seeds, contains phytosterols or phytosterols, plant sterols. Sterols sounds like steroids. You're on the right track. They're hormonal precursors. There is no estrogen in red clover.
Okay, that's where I was confused.
Plants don't
so
make
much.
Human hormones. Why would they? So there is no estrogen in there. You're making plenty of estrogen. What red clover has is potential. Like everything in the bean family, and we know that the healthiest, longest-lived people eat something from the bean family daily, right? What they have is the possibility of hormones.
Right, and it's so plant hormones.
And that possibility depends on your gut flora.
Right, but plant estrogens are very different than,
They aren't estrogens. They're not
okay.
Estrogens. They're phytosterols. There are maybe 3 plants that actually contain estradiol estrone or estrace.
Aha. Okay. Thank you.
I think seeds of pomegranates, orange peel.
Yeah.
Very young green beans. I mean, you can literally count on the fingers of one hand plants that actually contain estrogen.
Okay, so that
the rest of them contain sterols, and your body has to convert those sterols into hormones, and your body can convert those sterols into any hormones it wants. It can convert them into progesterone, into testosterone. It can convert them into estrogen. It can convert them into any hormone. They're building blocks. They're not an apartment building.
Yay.
Right?
Thank you, Susan.
So what is the best time to drink red clover?
Anytime at all.
I wouldn't drink it every day.
No, not all the time. I only do it a few times rotating and through the month. And it's not
working with your five herbs and you're not doing it every single day.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that helps. I just was like in for fertility in particular, wanting to maximize the benefits of having that in rotation, and just thought that I would ask the question just to kind of clarify.
I certainly do find that red clover increases your chances of conception and maintaining that pregnancy.
But
if you want to do it a little more than once every 5 days, that wouldn't hurt.
Right. Okay.
So if you're doing it once every 5 days now and you want to do it once every 4 days or, every third day, feel into how that feels for you.
Right. I find it really drying, so I honestly use it
more sparingly.
So I just kind of do what feels right for me and just without a curiosity, to share that.
The other really good dietary item in terms of fertility is animal fat.
Right. I do lots of that.
Right.
I'm like, thank you. Oh, I appreciate your show. I appreciate everything you do in the world. Thank you so much for... continuing people's medicine in the way you do.
Thank you. Green blessings.
Blessings.
Good night.
All right. And there are two callers that have pressed 1 to raise their hand with a question. The next caller is dialed in from the 908 area code. From the 908, you are live with Susan.
Hi, Susan. It's Carol from New Jersey.
Hey, Carol.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. We had a good time on the Hypericum conference. Thank you so much.
It was so wonderful to see you there. What were the highlights for you?
Oh, gee, it's hard to say. I think I like Zara, and I like being with Zara from Detroit, sort of in the middle of the city with her beautiful garden. Am I saying the right person's name?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I liked her presentation a lot. All of them were excellent. It's I know you asked that question of Sarah Allen, and it's hard to pick, but... Yes, absolutely, and I enjoyed every minute with you and Sarah Allen. So I have a couple questions. First of all, blessings on all your travels. I think it's wonderful that you're going to the Midwest and then to the international. It's so healing and wonderful. And the international, you had mentioned a couple months ago of a discount place where you went to get a discount. I know it's too late, but maybe for the 2 years from now. What was the name of that?
Come on, brain. Mason Hutchins. What is he calling it? Herb Rally.
Herb Rally?
Herb Rally. RALLY. Herb Rally.
Okay. It's like a website you go to?
Yeah, it has all kinds. And all kinds of stuff. He goes out and he interviews herbalists, and it's there, and you can, subscribe to the channel, and just all kinds of fun things.
Wow. Oh,
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fabulous. Okay, I'll definitely look that up. What are you planting now? And addressing. I'm in a condo, and so I'm trying to grow on the deck and in containers.
Well,
I
was going to say, well, you have to understand that because of the deer, I grow on the deck. So here's what I have seeded. I have California poppy seeded, and it's got its first true leaves, and it really needs to be transplanted, hoping to get to that tomorrow. I have some winter squash seeded, and they're just cotyledons. Their first leaves aren't out, but they get pretty big roots. they'll need to be transplanted soon. There's a few mint starts here. The morning glories, I was talking about calendula, lots and lots of calendula. I planted a wildflower mix, and most of what came up looks like calendula from the wildflower mix. And I planted a couple of castor bean seeds, and they came up, and some sunflowers. And what else? I bought some tomato starts. Cherry tomatoes do so well on decks. And I've been talking for years about the seeds from my sister's grapefruit tree that I've been growing. And I have one plant that's looking a little yellow. I'm not sure what it's unhappy about, but I'll see when I get home what I can do about it. And then one that's really happy and healthy, and one that also looks a little yellow, a little unhappy. Not sure what it's unhappy about. And some herbs. Herbs grow really well in containers and do super well on decks. Rosemary and thyme and parsley and chives all do super well. And when I was adding plants, I just couldn't resist thinking of these miniature lilies. These lilies are, when my fingers in the soil, the lilies do not reach to my elbow. That's how small they are.
Lilies,
and they're just perfect for containers because they don't get, you know, big and sprawly. And so I got one in red and one in yellow, being how they were only $5 each. And the plants that made it through the winter, the scented geraniums made it through the winter, some of the coleus made it through the winter, the flowering geraniums made it through the winter, there's an herb pot that has sweet woodruff and sage and rosemary, and I'm going to plant some oregano, which somebody gave me for my birthday, which is saying, get me out of this pot already, would you? So those are the kinds of things you can easily grow on deck.
Yes, a few years, when I was there many years ago, you were growing red shiso leaves. Are you doing that again?
Oh, absolutely. It just grows, you know. Once you get shiso going, it makes sure that it's always around.
Yeah, so Johnny seeds maybe for the shiso seeds. I don't have any shiso right now.
Well, that's an excellent place to start. I know they do have them, yes.
Oh,
yes,
perfect.
And I see it, you know, popping up here and here and here and here in planters and around and about. Wonderful to have. Yeah.
Oh, perfect. So I didn't realize that. Most everything is on the deck for you.
Yes.
Oh, perfect.
Yes, you know, goat keepers may have gardens, but gardeners cannot keep goats.
Oh, wonderful.
Right. So I need to keep, you know, most of my cultivating to a place where, or to plants that neither deer nor goats appreciate, and that's the entire mint family. Many things in the onion family they will leave alone.
Okay.
Goats not always. I've seen them munch their way through a lot of wild chives out in the woods.
Okay. Speaking of that, you had just
the woodchuck also, I find, leaves my onions and chives and mint family plants alone.
Good. You had just said something about 1 month before other things, you're eating things from outside. I didn't understand what you meant. You said garlic, mustard, and then
most people who garden.
Yes.
Don't have crops from their garden yet.
Right.
So if they started kale, they're probably not eating cooked kale yet.
No.
But I'm eating cooked garlic mustard.
Oh, okay.
Without having to garden at all.
Yeah, but that's out on the property. It's not, it's growing on the property everywhere. Yeah, perfect.
Well, it actually prefers more cultivated areas. You know, it's going to
crowd
up in the gardens. It likes to be there.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And I'm also able to pick a really nice variety of plants for my salads.
Yes. Perfect.
And, again, many people who garden are just starting to be able to pick, like, little baby lettuce leaves.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
If, you know, if you've cold-framed and if you've, you know, really, like, you know, dealt with the weather, or you live a little south of me, you might even be, you know, up more. But our first CSA share is not until the first week of June.
Oh, right, Catskills.
Right? Because
yeah,
the gardeners aren't really getting stuff from their gardens until June. Whereas we've been eating weeds for several months now.
Okay. And did you freeze
the
metal?
So in a way, that makes those who are living off the land different and somewhat suspect. Because they don't go to the marketplace, to the agora.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Did you freeze some nettles?
Oh, it's far too early in the year to freeze it.
The nettles. Oh, I see.
Yeah, just making a nettle soup and eating it. And
yeah, okay.
Really enjoying the fresh green nettle.
Oh,
I was just looking
at
my nettle patch and saying, wow, you know, for next class weekend, we might harvest nettle to dry as well as nettle for soup. It's really growing fast.
Super good. Oh, wonderful. All right.
Yeah.
Blessings, Susan. Thank you for all your wisdom.
Well, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I love you. I love you, Sarah Allen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank
Mwah.
You.
Love you, too. Bye-bye.
Mwah. Aw, thank you, Carol. All right. And I'll remind everyone, if you have a question this evening for Susan, please press 1 so that we can see your hand go up in the queue. Our next caller has dialed in from the 973 area code. From the 973, you are live with Susan.
Hi, Sarah Ellen, and hi, Susan. Thanks for all the information on your blog talk each week. I'm really grateful that you shared your travel schedule. I also know it's on your e-zine about the places that you're doing workshops. And I was very intrigued and wanted to call in about the Red Earth gathering in Colorado. Specifically, you are doing a workshop that I believe is called After. And I was wondering if you are doing that workshop on the East Coast or at your place that future participants can register for if I'm not able to get to Colorado, but I'm very interested in taking that workshop with you.
Thank you. Astrid wasn't able to firm up the dates for Red Earth until after my yearly workshop schedule was already set. So I don't have that on this year's workshop schedule, but I will certainly add it to next year's.
And is that something that I know on your website on occasion if people want to do private consults and make, I believe it's a 4-hour appointment in advance for a one-on-one session with you, is that, would you do a modification of that workshop for individuals at your, you know, at a set time and fee?
Yes. However, let me be a little bit clearer. You can go to wisewomanbookshop.com and book a one-on-one consultation with me for as little as 20 minutes.
Thank you.
And
that's
helpful. The fee, you know, is appropriate to whatever the time span is. You can book your day with Susan, which is 5 hours. for up to five people for $500. And I come to your house, and I'm willing to travel a certain amount for free, and then after that, you need to pay. You can take a correspondence course, and each correspondence course comes with 3 hours of private time with me.
Thank you so much for this clarifying information. It's very helpful.
Good. Good. I think correspondence course is really good if there's something ongoing, because it allows for us to stay connected and talk to each other without a time limit.
That's lovely.
I just found a letter someone had written me at the beginning of COVID. And I wrote to her and I said, I hope you're still at this address, but I'm answering you. And she wrote back and she said, oh, this is the perfect timing. The whole, you know, the whole COVID thing, this has been happening. That's right. I wouldn't have been able to answer you at all. So this is, I'm so glad that you intuitively knew, you know.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that's, you know, there's no pressure with the correspondence course. And I've had people who get the correspondence course just for the time and don't do any of the projects. That's absolutely fine. You don't have to feel beholden.
Thank you so much for your time and all of your wisdom in medicine. I appreciate it.
You are welcome. Thanks for your call. Dream blessings. Good
Green
night.
Green blessings.
All right, and I'll remind you, if you have a question this evening for Susan, please press 1 so that your hand go up in the queue. Our next caller with the raised hand has dialed in from the 646 area code. From the 646, you are.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi, Steve, the guy with the hernia, remember?
Yes.
How are you?
I am so enjoying this lovely weather. How about you?
Good. Yeah, very good, actually. Thank you. Down in South Florida. So I wanted to ask, so I've got a date booked for surgery on 8th of June. I looked everywhere to find a surgeon that could do the shoulder ice method, but I struggled greatly to find that.
Sorry to hear that. What a disappointment for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's my second hernia. I had one on the other side. I don't remember me saying last time.
Yeah.
And I had the mesh last time, and my body's taken to that, you know, successfully.
So your body's all right with that.
Yeah, so hopefully second time.
Well, hopefully it will be with this one too. We'll just say, oh, another one, a pair.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
fingers crossed. So I'm, my call really is just, you know, I've been drinking herbal infusions now for maybe 18 months. I just wanted to know any sort of pre-op and post-op recommendations on I know Comfrey's, you know, certainly one of my favorites as well as yours. Can you recommend anything I can be taking just to help with the repair?
One of the things that was brought up over and over again at the Hypericum conference was what a remarkable healer of injuries Hypericum is, and especially surgical injuries.
Okay.
And that repair takes place in a nerve-rich area, and Hypericum is also ideal for repairing and restoring nerves that have been cut by surgery. It has certainly been a daily companion for me since my surgery. I don't,
okay.
I'm not completely back to full expression of my nerves, especially because there was cutting around my, you know, part of my spine was cut off.
Okay.
And, right? So Hypericum has just been such a savior to me. I also have had musculoskeletal pain because of that and have found Kava a very
Yeah. I've heard you talk to Kava quite.
Yeah, you know, I put an ounce in, you know, 4 to 6 cups of water and boil it for a while. I want to have about a quart when I'm done. So it depends, you know, how much I put it. How long am I going to actually stand there and let it boil before I get distracted? Right. And because it's pretty expensive, I usually redo it. I usually do it again the second time. It's a root,
right.
So it's got a lot to give, yeah.
And then how much is it?
It can cost $100 a pound or more. So it's
Okay.
Yeah, it's really expensive. I'm not sure why, but
okay.
A good quality kava is really a gift of the gods.
Okay.
So blessed to have that. But what I usually find is that. We are the guardians, in a way, of our bodies, you know?
Yeah.
We are not supposed to tell our bodies to walk into traffic. We are supposed to remind our bodies that eating thirds for dessert will probably have us up in the middle of the night groaning. You know, we're supposed to protect and take care of our bodies. And so when we purposely put our body in harm's way, when we purposely let people cut us, and needles into us, our body is betrayed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's important part of the healing to apologize in some way. It doesn't have to, you don't have to beg forgiveness, but it, you know, what do we want when we've been betrayed or hurt? We want acknowledgement, right?
Yeah, I think healing meditation for one is definitely a good way to
Perhaps
to the body maybe, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, to
okay.
say, hey, I really get it that I let you be cut up and how can I be kind to you now?
Yeah.
One of my physical therapists wanted me to stroke my scar.
Okay.
And you know what? When she asked me to, I didn't want to.
Okay.
Because, of course, I was upset that there was this scar.
Yeah, it's like a battle wound, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're very open, and that will stand you in very good stead. You'll get cues and knowings and leanings and inclinations.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
And just listen to that inner voice as well. Okay.
Yeah, you're doing great. You're taking care of yourself now, and you'll continue to take care of yourself. And since you're listening in, you'll know what to do.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. The Carver route. What kind of amounts would you recommend taking if I was to drink it just like a regular infusion, or
so different for different people, and it's such an interesting plant. I was sharing Carver root with someone who has this chronic neck pain, and he went for acupuncture for, you know, weekly for like nearly a year, and he said while he was being needled, it completely eliminated the pain. Within 5 minutes of leaving, it was right back. So that really hasn't worked for him at all, and so we're trying out various herbal pain relievers because they're so individual. and I offered him some cover root brew, some infusion, actually decoction, since it's boiled.
Yeah.
Although it's allowed to steep in the hot water after that, right, for overnight. So it's kind of an infusion decoction. And then rebrew as well. And I said, you know, at the Herbalist Ball at the International Herb Symposium, we usually drink kava and dance all night. I said, but you'll also see it listed as a sedative, that if you drink it, it'll put you to sleep. And he looked, and I said, yeah. Right? When you're working with it, it can take you whichever side of that you want. You want to stay up and do things, it'll go with you. You want to just, like, go to sleep, it will carry you off to sleep.
Yeah.
And over a period of an hour, he drank in sips, you know, not little baby sips, but, you know, glug, but not like chugging. Maybe a cup of it.
Okay.
And he said that it did seem to relieve the pain.
Okay, that's cool. I'm quite excited.
I said, so you have to feel into how much you need. Like with an herb this expensive, you're going to, like me, try to see what's the littlest I can get away with here. But have it be effective.
Yeah.
And oftentimes at the beginning you'll need more, and then once your body learns how to use it, you can use less.
Okay.
I also told him, I gave him the jar of it that I brought over, and I said, you do keep it refrigerated, but if it ferments, it's okay, because traditionally it was fermented. And I have certainly found that the fermented brew can be quite a bit more effective.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I had some that was with me in Costa Rica, and it fermented, and then it went so far beyond fermented, it was like, oh, get that out of the car, bad smell.
Wow.
So in a really tropical climate, the fermented stage does not last long.
Wow, I bet.
I remember when I was first reading about it, that they went out and dug the kava root in the morning and then chewed it up to mix it with saliva and spit it into like a wooden vessel, and then mashed it and pounded it and added water to it and let it cook and ferment like a sun tea. And then there was a kava ritual each evening. So... that's one of the reasons that I tried fermenting it, because I thought, oh, I'm sure if they let that sit out, it was bubbly by the time they were drinking it.
Yeah, sounds exciting.
So things to try.
I'll definitely give that a try. And you think if I was to make make some a couple of days before the surgery and then pop it in the fridge, should last for...
I find that it lasts for a week or two.
Yeah, and I'll add
and then the rebrew lasts again.
And then put that should be great. And I'll continue drinking the comfrey infusion. What's the other one we said? Oh, the hypericum. Should I do that as a tincture?
I like to use hypericum as a tincture.
I'm a couple of days into the conference. I just I pick it up and do an hour, and then I come back to it, and you know. So I love it. Thank you so much for that wonderful gift.
You are so welcome.
Yeah.
What I mean, everyone is so generous. Just the wealth of personal experience and clinical experience and connection and emotion and spirit. Wow.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and it's just the unity of it is just I love it so much. I'm very proud of you and Sarah Ellen, and I just love the community as a whole, and what you've achieved is just phenomenal. So well done.
Thank you.
And, I'd love to be a speaker one day on the next one, for sure.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay.
We always announce it in the e-zine.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get the notice about the e-zine, then and just glance through, then you should see that. And you listen to the blog talk, and you know Ellen and I, of course, talk about it. So you'll know that too.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, thank you so much, Susan.
Green blessings. Thanks for your call.
Thank you. See you now. Bye.
All right. And looks like at this time I'm not seeing any hands, so I'll remind everyone, if you've got a question and would like to speak live with Susan this evening, please press 1 so that we can see your hand go up in the queue. And I do see someone has raised their hand from the 541 area code. From the 541, you are live with Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because listening to you on the last caller piqued an issue that I've been dealing with scar tissue. And I've got, well, basically after giving birth, I had a vaginal tear that needed stitches, and I had that same aversion when the physical therapist suggested that I, you know, massage the scar tissue. I couldn't do it. So, but I feel like now that time has passed, you know, I've got less aversion to doing that. But I'm also curious of any other healing techniques. I know I'm kind of interested in vaginal steaming too. I've read some things that can help with that as well. And I was thinking maybe doing like a comfrey infusion as a steam. And then I've also heard like castor oil, which I've never used. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on healing vaginal scar tissue.
If steaming appeals to you, that sounds lovely.
Okay.
It seems so moistening. And if it seems too complicated, a soak does the same thing.
That was kind of my question, yeah, because, like, I've
done and you can actually even soak in a bathtub. You don't even have to do a sitz bath.
Right. And you did that early on. I just, you know, I haven't...
So, you know, that's my primary gripe with any kind of steam, is it's just so awkward and inconvenient.
Right.
And I'm a lazy girl. I do not want to go to such a fuss.
Yeah.
If I could just run a bath and sit in it, how much easier than maneuvering myself over a steaming pan and being worried about burns and because I'm also a klutz. Right? If there's a pan of steaming water around, I'm going to step in it. I'm going to spill it. I'm going to make a mess. Whereas in the bathtub, the mess is contained. Thank you.
Do you
have to work who you are. Some people, you know, that stuff just totally works for them, and blessed be. I actually saw somebody, you know, decide she was doing a facial steam and had the towel over her head go up in flames because she was doing it over a gas fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, maybe there's another way to do this besides the steam.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to put the fire out. She was not burned, but it was a scary moment.
Yeah.
So now whenever anybody's talking about steam, I say, do be sure to take it off the fire before you put your face or any part of your body over it, especially because you usually are draping yourself around the steam, right? With a skirt or a towel or something to contain the steam, and that's how she got caught on fire.
That'd be a little hard with the vaginal.
Well, not if you had it on a burner, let me tell you. Unfortunately, hoping that you wouldn't, right? Oh, I'm remembering, gosh, this funny women's gathering where I was cooking for 300, and one of the smaller women jumped up on the stove to mash the potatoes. I think they were in a 20-gallon pan. This pan was nearly as big as she was.
A hardy stove.
Oh, my gosh. What a vaginal steam that would be.
Yeah.
And, of course, also applying any kind of oil. One of the it was a student Zoom session that I had during the conference, not part of the conference, and one of my distant students said that she found it was a really excellent sexual lubricant and helped to reduce scar tissue at the same time.
What was?
Hypericum oil.
Oh, hypericum oil. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that her husband thought it made him last longer.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's another issue is painful sex.
Yeah. So I think hypericum oil is really poised to be your ally there.
Okay. More so than comfrey, then.
You could use both of them, but remember that hypericum reduces pain, especially pain from something that's pierced.
Okay.
And if you have a surgical scar, you've been pierced. You've been sewn, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Or stapled, which is piercing, too.
Stitched, yeah.
Yes, stitched, stapled, right? Pierced. And that's a specific for hypericum.
Okay, hypericum oil.
Yeah, hypericum oil. And then maybe the steam or the bath could be comfrey.
Right. Huh? Yeah. Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah. I'm glad that we're both in a place where we're willing to touch our scars.
Yeah, it's been a slow process. There's, you know, a lot of emotion in the vaginal opening as well. So
I really hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like relearning yourself.
It is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like reintroducing yourself to your own body.
I really, really hear you. I don't know if you know, but they took a muscle out of my belly and reconstructed my vagina from it.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
So it was definitely like relearning, like, who is this, you know, new put-together person, and how does she relate to who I was before? And there's that interesting continuity of self.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That allows us to know that we are the same being who is now experiencing, oh, surprise, surprise, change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same but different, I guess.
Exactly. We get a new choice every time.
Yes. We're the snake or the lizard shedding our skin.
Oh, what a lovely image.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate your perspective on that. And I wish you well with your scar tissue journey as well.
Thank you. Yes, my third year anniversary of the surgery just passed. Wow.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Hey, all right. Green
blessing. Getting out there and infusing the herbal community with your live and in-person wisdom. That's great.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Good night. Three blessings.
Hi, and we've got about 20 minutes before our guest is scheduled to join us. And if you have a question for Susan,
please press 1 so that we can see your hand in the queue. And at this time, I'm not seeing any raised hands. We do have an email question. Actually, we have a couple email questions. So if you'd like, we can go there.
Yes, I would.
All right. Oh, well, actually, I also see a hand just went up. Which do you want first?
Well, let's deal with the hand and then.
All right. Here we go. To the hand that has been raised from the 310 area code. From the 310, you're live with Susan.
Hi.
Hi.
I heard there were no callers, and I actually just called in. I heard the last little bit of the last caller, and I thought I would just pop in to share something. It's really interesting. I just heard you mention hypericum oil with any sort of puncture. And I was just really fascinated when I heard you say that because I recently got a tattoo, and coincidentally, I had just listened to your show. Someone called in a few weeks ago and asked about the purpose of tattoos and do you find them, you know, do you find any meaning in them? And so you had a conversation about that on the show. And I think I heard that, I think perhaps the day before I was planning to get my tattoos, which were to honor a friend of mine who passed. Mm. And I got 2 ginkgo leaves overlapping, one yellow and one green. And one represented her and one represents me. And after, this is my first tattoo, and I just had this sense, I didn't know if it was right or not, but I just thought, you know what, I'm going to put some hypericum oil on beforehand. I knew that they were going to be putting some sort of alcohol solution to clean the area before, so I knew that there would be no oil getting into it. and I didn't know if that was okay or not. But, I mean, if oil gets in, you know, anyhow. So I put the oil on beforehand. It didn't hurt very much, a little bit, a lot less than I expected. But then over the next few days afterward, I just was really drawn to just using the hypericum oil. And I didn't know why, but I just did it. And I've been in hardly any pain, and it's been, you know, 2 or 3 weeks now, and it's, you know, people talk about, oh, the healing, and it hurts, you know, for a few weeks, and this and that, the other thing, and it's like, oh, what healing? I mean, it hurt, I think, for the night of, it kind of was burning a bit, and then since then, it's just been, I haven't even noticed, it's as if it were there, had been there for a year is kind of what it feels like. And so I just wanted to share that. I just heard the last bit of that last call, and I thought I would pop in just to share that bit of information.
Wow. I am so happy you shared that with us. Thank you. Thank you so much. And toward the end of the Hypericum Conference, Sarah Ellen had a brilliant idea. And the Wise Woman Spiral has agreed to go along with Sarah Ellen's brilliant idea, which is that the Hypericum Conference will continue to be open to anyone who wants to send in a short.
Oh, wow.
So if you want to make a short and for some reason you haven't signed up for the Hypericum Conference, we will pay you for your short by giving you admission.
All right.
This is exactly
well,
Yeah, just the kind of short that we want. This is, you know, absolutely perfect, a first-hand experience of how you used it and what your results were. So.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, so what should she do if she does that, Sarah Ellen?
Oh, let's see. The link for the short is still the same link, is my understanding. So you can look back at any of the old e-zines that have the Hypericum short. So you could just, like, search in your inbox or your email box, e-zine Hypericum short, and it should come up that way. Also, I would check Facebook, and the post for the last 2 weeks, you should see the shorts link there as well.
Thank you.
And that's to submit one as well. Right. Perfect.
That's just, okay. It's just the link to submit.
Oh, just to submit. Got it, got it. Oh, I understand. Okay. Right.
Okay,
you
wonderful. Wisewomanschool.com, where you would go to purchase the conference, and then in that, there's also probably still the link for the shorts is also still there.
Okay. Okay. Great. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your time, Susan.
Thank you for your sharing. Green blessings.
All right.
Good.
Green blessings. Good night.
All right. And I am not seeing a hand. And if you are listening and you would like to ask a question, we still do have about 15 minutes per question. So please press 1 to raise your hand, and we'll see your hand there in the queue. We can go to that email question if you're ready for that. Susan?
Yes, I am.
Okay, excellent. All right. Hi, Susan. My question is not about plants, but people, specifically my 4-year-old daughter. She experienced an incident last year in which the swim instructor we brought her to for learning to swim lessons suddenly picked up my daughter and jumped into the deep end of the pool with her. Her head went under, and she swallowed water, and she's now terrified of getting in the pool and learning to swim. We live in a neighborhood where many of our friends have pools, and we enjoy beach vacations, and our in-laws have a house where we visit frequently, and there is a pool there. Because of all this, we think it is a good idea that our daughter is capable in the water, even if she does not like swimming. Any suggestions on how we can help our daughter feel comfortable trying to learn to swim again? Many thanks.
You know, all life can be conditioned. That was Pavlov's experiment, right? Could he condition the dogs to salivate at the sound of a bell? So he would sound a bell, and then he would feed them, and he would sound a bell and feed them. And he lengthened the time between sounding the bell and feed them. And as he lengthened them, they were conditioned to know they were going to be fed at the sound of the bell, and so they would salivate at the sound of the bell if there wasn't food there. So what we're talking about here is adverse conditioning. Your daughter was adversely conditioned to the water because she went into the water in a way that was very frightening to her. You want her to be safe in the water rather than frightened by the water. And I agree with you. I think swimming is a very important skill. So what you're asking is, how do I make the water safe for her again? She must take baths or showers. That's where we start. She has experiences with being in the water. My teachers tell me the best way through a trauma, especially where I felt helpless, is to recreate it so that I'm in charge of it. Don't want our children to drown if we're at the beach or near a swimming pool. We do not want our child to fall in or run in or somehow jump into the water and not know how to stay afloat. So it's not even so much knowing how to swim. And I remember that my first instruction was not in swimming, but in floating. And even in the bathtub, unless she's an enormous 4-year-old, she can float. And how do you help her float? You put your hands under her and you hold her. Enough water in the bathtub, enough warm water. When she leans back, you help her float. And bit by bit, as she grows more confident and more secure, there comes it. A little water splashes onto her face, and you're right there with her. Maybe you're even floating together. And we don't try to hide that there was fear there. We know that fear becomes courage. I wish I knew what her name was.
Oh, me too. They don't say.
No.
All right. Were you finished with that, answering that one?
I am. I am. Green blessings.
All right. Excellent. I'll remind everyone, we still have about 8 minutes. If you have a question and would like to raise your hand, please press 1. And we'll see your hands go up in the queue. This time I'm not seeing a hand, but I do have one other email question.
Let me hear it, please.
All right. Hi, Susan. Thank you with all my heart for all you are and all you share. I have a question about dandelions. Will you please share some other ways that I can play and prepare dandelion remedies or foods? The flowers are everywhere now, and I would love to try some new experiments beyond a typical tincture or oil. Thanks for all your knowledge and inspiration.
Well, I'm sure the dandelion flowers have all gone out to dandelion clocks now, unless you go up, up, up a mountain or live very high. But for future reference, there are a lot of dandelion recipes in my green book, Healing Wise, page after page of dandelion recipes. Plus, Peter Gale, who was he's a professor at some college, and he had his students do some project about wild foods that people ate. They came back with all this information about dandelion, and he realized that people all over the world eat dandelion. And he started, putting out dandelion recipes, and he would even, for several years, he had a dandelion cook-off that he sponsored. Then people from all over came to make dandelion recipes. His name is Peter, P-E-T-E-R, Gale, G-A-L-E. And since we live in a time when one can get anything at all, you can find some of the dandelion books that Peter Gale put out, his original one with all of those recipes. But then, of course, he also put out books from his cook-offs, from all of the winning recipes. So, one of my favorite uses for the dandelion flowers, of course, is to make dandelion wine. And there is a recipe in the green book for that. And I also like to make dandelion fritters. And the king of dandelion dude, Peter Gale. Is this the same Peter Gale, the king of dandelions, talks and courses? Yes, the dandelion celebration. There it is, around the world in 80 plants. Oh, my gosh. Even though I'm saddened to learn that one of America's leading foragers, Peter Gale, has died He inspired me to buy his book, Dandelion Celebration, in 1994. He was the first person I came across who planted a dandelion bed in his garden, and he organized the National Dandelion Cook-Off in Dover, Ohio, for many, many years. And so this person, I can't find out what his name is giving a little thing about it. But if you look up Peter Gail, G-A-I-L, you will, I'm sure, find some other interesting dandelion recipes, if not from Peter Gail himself, from lovers of dandelions. Thanks for asking. Green blessings.
Wow, that is awesome. I love that. It's dandelion bed. I have never seen
dandelion a dude.
Dude. Yeah, I would have planted dandelion.
So a dandelion bed, right? They plant a dandelion bed. Ay, 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 ay.
I've never seen one planted intentionally. That's so fun. Okay. I do see Kylia is here, and I am
not seeing
another hand.
Let's go ahead and get started.
All right.
Did you say there was another hand or there isn't?
There's not. No.
Okay, good. Kylia Taylor, MS. LMFT, is licensed therapist who has been thinking, writing, and teaching about ethics for almost three decades. She developed and teaches inner ethics, a self-reflective, self-compassionate approach to relational ethics. The model includes a set of awareness tools that are especially useful to those working with psychedelic-assisted therapy. Kylia started studying with Stanislav and Christina Groff in 1984. She's worked as a senior trainer in the Groff Transpersonal Training throughout the 1990s and is the author of The Ethics of Caring, Finding Right Relationship with Clients, published in 2017, plus several books about holotropic breath work. Welcome to the show, Kylia.
Hi, Susan. I've been listening. It's very interesting.
I'm so glad you were able to be here for the show. You know, ethics, and especially medical ethics and psychedelic ethics, is a topic that's extremely close to my heart. I don't know any other teacher of herbal medicine who gives her apprentices a whole talk on ethics before she graduates.
Wow, that's great. I think we all need more information about ethics, and I think ethics is really becoming a theme in life and even TV series and all kinds of things right now, because I think we've been a little bit skewed in not paying attention to the needs of people and our responsibilities when we have them to take care of people.
So why don't you start out by explaining to listeners what it is we're talking about? What are ethics? Are ethics rules? Are they morals? Are they your conscience? What is ethics anyhow?
Well, I think ethics has to do with when you're something that I call a responsible party, when you've either been drafted into that role or you volunteered for it or it's your job, you're a professional. And when you're a responsible party, you're probably going to be dealing with people who are vulnerable and who are depending on you to pay attention to their needs instead of your own. And I have a term that I came up with in the early 90s, right relationship. And I came to it because there wasn't a term for what the relationship is when it's really right, when it's doing what it should do for both parties in their roles. And so I looked at what is going on when there's right relationship. and what is going on when there's not right relationship. And how I got interested in ethics was really because I was working with Stan Grof, as you said, in the Grof Transpersonal Training, which teaches people how to be holotropic breathwork practitioners. And there were a few people who were licensed therapists. There was not a lot, but there were a few that really puzzled me because they were good people. And they really had the best interests of their clients at heart. And yet, when they went home to work with extraordinary states of consciousness, is what I call them, with a vulnerable client in their private offices, they got into ethical trouble. They did harm to their clients, and not intending to, but they did. And they also hurt themselves. And so I really got puzzled about that and wondering, well, what is this? Because these people had had ethics courses because they were licensed. And I realized that the ethics courses really were teaching, the traditional ones were teaching do's and don'ts. Don't do this. Do this. This is the law. This is the standards of practice. And they weren't doing anything about talking about what happens before behaviors, before unethical behaviors, like motivations and biases and attitudes. And so there's always something going on that may or may not be conscious in us that could result in ethical misconduct if we don't know ourselves and if we don't kind of look and do self-inquiry when we have that gut feeling. I loved what you said about following your knowings and inclinations, and I think we get hints, you know, that maybe our gut flips or something, that we know something is not right in the relationship. And that's the time that we need to do self-inquiry, I think, and relational, what I call relational reflection. So that was a lot. That was like kind of how I got started in this. And yeah.
Well, since you're listening, let's work with the ethical question that we were just presented with. The woman who took a 4-year-old and jumped into the deep end with her.
That's right. Well, I think everybody would agree that she did something unethical. She was going against what you called safety. And she was going against her role as responsible party to provide protection for this child and to introduce this child to swimming in a way that was safe. And I think everybody, when there's any learning going on, there's always vulnerability. And the responsible party is responsible for protecting that vulnerability. And I think you also always have to have a little bit of risk when you're learning. You go out of your safety zone a little bit. But you have to do it in a way that's safe enough to actually do the learning. Otherwise, we protect ourselves, we shut down, we dissociate, we get really fearful, and, you know, we're not going anywhere that's going to result in new learning if we're that scared.
Yes, the learning that we get from fear does not last very long.
No.
No. It definitely can change our behavior, but it's not a lasting change. I wouldn't count on it.
Well, it might be a lasting change in terms of if you hit the hot oven, you know that you're never going to hit the hot oven again. But it's not going to be...
Well, unless you're a baker, and then you know you're going to hit it again. Right?
That's true. That's true.
No, you know that it comes with doing it. Okay, if I'm going to be putting bread or cakes or whatever it is in and out of this oven, I am going to get burned now and then, no matter how careful I am.
That's very true.
That's very true. I'm willing to take that risk. And I think that's perhaps a place where it gets a little harder to know, you know, are my son-in-law actually taught culinary arts at the Culinary Institute of America? And, you know, he certainly didn't put anybody into a situation where they would get cut or burned, and nonetheless, some of his students got very grievously cut.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're picking up fire and knives if you're in the kitchen.
Yes. Well, I think that's true, and I think those people were probably adults enough to know that they were going to be dealing with ovens and hot ovens and knives, but this child probably didn't know
what it felt
like to, yeah.
Psychedelics, in a way, are like hot ovens and knives.
Yeah, they are. They're a tool.
They're a tool, and they're a somewhat dangerous tool.
And there are risks.
And there are going to be risks when we are alive. That's about the size of it, right? Life itself is a terminal exercise, and living is risky.
Yeah.
I
like what you said about trauma, you know, just a little while ago. The best way through a trauma is to recreate it so you're in charge of it.
Right.
And maybe bring awareness into that recreation and so forth. And trauma comes up a lot in psychedelic sessions.
Yes.
Because somehow the inner healer in us, I don't know if you talk about the inner healer at all in your work, but the inner healer in us is going to bring up the situation that is ready to be healed. And if we cooperate with it, and if we go into the psychedelic session deciding that we will cooperate with whatever comes up, then we're in a better situation to get through that process and come out with some good results.
To come out, I think with what we're talking about is the ability to see ourselves in a different way rather than to run the same routine.
Yes, because that's change. That's
right.
Consciousness development. Yeah.
And one of my teachers always said when somebody had a break, we'll never get through that place again. You'll brick it up now. You'll allow that change, but you won't allow that entrance into your psyche anymore.
Interesting.
Yes, I thought that was interesting. And I think it's true. I think we do. You know, I had taken and guided over 500 LSD trips.
Uh-huh. That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. I have seen a lot of trauma come up and how people relate to it, you know, anything from, you know, taking off all your clothes because you don't want to be, you know, in this world anymore to really changing the course of a life. And
it does. Yeah.
And there isn't a formula. It's not like, oh, if you do X, Y, and Z, everybody will get to the right place, because what's happening is so uniquely individual.
Yeah, that's why a lot of my teaching is about relational reflection.
Yes.
And
yeah.
The therapeutic container in therapy language.
Do you want to tell us more about that?
Well, what I figured out was that there were in psychedelic work, everything gets amplified. That's something that Stan Grof said, and everybody is picking up on that at this point. And so what
yes, it's not, it's, they're not hallucinogen amplifiers. It's different.
Well, what I'm meaning about that right now is that anything that you say, anything that you do as a responsible party in the psychedelic session can be taken and blown up by the person in terms of what that means to them. And the other way that works is that here's this responsible party sitting in the session, and they're in the field, they're in the energetic field of this thing happening. And surprising things will happen to the sitter, and I'm sure you can vouch for that too. Material that comes from the unconscious will arise for the sitter too. And what do you do with that? Well, the first thing is that you really need a lot of experience doing the work yourself. But as a responsible party, I realized that there were some areas of ethics that if people had an ethical awareness tool for each one of those areas, then they would have something to retrieve kind of on the spot and use to see, you know, sort out and make the right choice at that point.
Ooh.
Rather, yeah. So
wow.
I came up, yeah.
That's great.
So I'll tell you one of them, which is really easy. And so many people, you know, I've been kind of the steward for this art, expressive arts project for about process method for about 20 years. And we have taught this tool in the training for soul collage facilitators. And they've all used it really well. And it's just the question, who's this for? So it identifies any conflict of interest between the responsible party and the experiencer. So if you're sitting there as a responsible party and you're thinking, well, I really need to touch this person who's in the session. They look like they need comforting, for example. You can say, well, who's this for? Is it because I need comforting because they're session is too scary for me? Or is it because they really do? And I can sit with that and I can see if something's coming up for me, I can see more clearly if there's a semi-conscious urge to comfort myself by touching this person or if it might be a good idea for them. So that's just an example, but it identifies conflicts of interest.
That seems like a very important example. And as you say, something that easily comes up. So we can perhaps revisit for a moment what is ethics and say that it has to do with self-reflection.
I think it does. It has to do with knowing yourself. And the question, how do I know myself? And self-reflection is one of the answers to that. Self-inquiry, which is taking self-reflection a little further and deeper, I think, is
another. Ooh, I like that.
And,
yeah.
And also, good. And also peer support, because I'm really into this right now because I'm writing a book on it because I think it's the way that this psychedelic renaissance is going to be served by community taking care of vulnerability in each other. So what it means is that we, you know, there's some, you probably know this, the Johari window. Do you know about the Johari window?
No.
No? Okay. Well, it was big in the 70s, and then it kind of just kind of faded for a while. It's a diagram by two guys named Joe and Harry, who it's a window with four squares. So there's a cross through the middle of it, and there's four sections. And in the first section is all the stuff you know about yourself and others know about you too. So it's your open and free area. And then another section is your blind area, and that is what you don't know about yourself, but others do. And so this is the area where you really find out some things about yourself by being in a peer consultation group, for example, or having supervision by others. And then there's another area where you know about yourself, but you don't want others to know, and they don't. It's all your secrets and things like that. And then the fourth section is your unknown area. And you learn about yourself by doing deep work, doing psychedelic work, doing meditation, doing therapy, going to workshops and seeing what comes up. So there's many, many ways to go about knowing yourself and participating in your own consciousness development. But I think the peer consultation groups are going to be a really good way. And what I realized was, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of peer consultation groups, but I thought what you really need is a structure that really protects vulnerability, because if we're there's a taboo about professionals really sharing any mistakes they make, because every professional thinks they have to be perfect, and maybe all the culture thinks they have to be too. But I think in a peer consultation group, this is a place where you can just be vulnerable and get protection and compassion from your peers first, because I think you need compassion before you're ready to do self-inquiry. And then get help with consultation about any kind of challenging relational problem that is coming up in your practice.
There was a place called the Rocky Mountain School for Botanical Studies in Boulder, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And the school provided a Wednesday evening get-together for graduates who were in clinical practice to come and talk about their problems.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, I was able to sit in on a couple of sessions, and I thought it was so incredibly valuable to even just know that there's a place where you can come and say, wow, you know, I really can't figure this out, or could somebody knowing that there are others.
Yes.
Makes
no,
such a difference.
Knowing you're not the only one making mistakes or worrying about this or that, and it's really important. And in my teaching, I try to do, you know, I think I use a lot of stories, and some of the stories are my own mistakes. So I'm trying to kind of give people the idea that it's okay to talk about mistakes. And I think, I don't know if you do that too, but I bet you do.
Yes. Yes, I think it's it's quite important to, well, you know, of course, I was brought up with the dictum that the difference between success and failure is getting up again.
Yeah. Yes.
So you have to be able to tolerate your own mistakes. What Thomas Edison was famous for saying, you know, after the 100th light bulb that didn't work, he says, well, now I know 100 ways it won't work.
Yes.
That kind of attitude, not what a miserable failure I am, but wow, now I've learned 100 ways that it won't work. Let's keep going.
That's really good. But I think you have an important point there about tolerating mistakes, and that's where the self-compassion comes in.
Mm.
And one of the things, and it's so easy to say, oh, I have to be self-compassionate before I do self-inquiry. However, how do you get the self-compassion when you're beating yourself up or in shame? And one of the ways I discovered that helps is to have a belief that there is a healing impulse in any behavior in a therapeutic situation, that you're either trying to heal somebody else or yourself or both. And you're not always skillful and you don't always have the right timing and you don't always have the right idea. But if you can give yourself points for having the right intention, then you can get to, okay, well, why was the impact better or worse than what I thought? Why did the impact cause harm, or why did it not work? So you have self-compassion about that inclination or that impulse before you do the self-inquiry.
Yes, you don't do self-inquiry as a way to be mean to yourself.
That is a really good point.
It's yes. Not an inquiry into how terrible you are. I like to follow my students out of the room if I can be inconspicuous and they don't know that I'm there, so that I can overhear what they haven't understood of what I've said so that I can say it better.
Mm-hmm. I think that's always a good idea.
Right. You have to be willing to know that you can do better.
Yeah, and you have
to me that's fascinating. I see that it's not so for everybody. That some people feel threatened, and as you say, it does have something to do with their sense of whether or not they're required to be perfect.
Yes, and what they expect that others are going to require them from. And that may have something to do, as it usually does, with how we're brought up and how much work we've done to get rid of all the programming that we have in our childhood or whatever. But I think you're right.
All of the armor that we have put on.
Yes.
In the belief that it will somehow protect us from life.
Really good point.
Right. And the only problem is if we succeed. Because then we're protected from life.
Uh-huh.
And then we feel lonely.
Yes.
Because we're protected from life.
Yep.
And that isn't really what we meant all along. We really wanted to be protected from harm.
Very good teachings.
Which is what you are talking to us about in terms of ethics. You know, where is the harm, and where can we honestly say, I will protect you against this harm, and where can we not? Certainly, you know, it is one of the most wrenching things for any of us to have to go through, is to see a beloved suffering from something that we can't cure or change.
Mm-hmm.
And to know in ourselves that sense of what we love, we cannot always protect.
Yes, and that gets into trusting, you know, trusting that the universe is friendly, I guess, and that everybody has their own path to learn from.
Yes. requires, I absolutely agree with you, an enormous trust. And my experience has been that that trust is rewarded.
Mine too.
That I agree with you that there is a healing energy, a healing force, that there is, shall we say, that which wishes us well.
Yes. Was it Einstein that said the question is the universe friendly? And we all have to come to our own decision about that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I really like recent research that has found that the first sign of dementia is paranoia.
Interesting.
So, pronoia is the way to go. Believe that the universe is benevolent, even if you have no reason to believe that.
Yes, well, you have to have a deep trust when some things happen in life, for sure.
Yeah.
To continue to believe that.
Well, you know, I have had such a good time talking to you that I have totally lost track of time. How can people get in touch with you if they want more? How can they find your books?
Yeah, innerethics.com. Easy to find. And
that's
my book
easy.
Is The Ethics of Caring.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
You are welcome. I would like you to leave something in the hearts and the minds of everyone who's listening to you tonight. How would you like to? Would you like to leave with them?
I would say, going into worth going into knowing yourself, and worth facing whatever is in the way of learning more about who you are and what you're feeling and what you want, and being able to do what is yours to do in life.
We are involved, I believe, in the project of reweaving the healing cloak of the ancients. And we need a lot of different threads to make this healing cloak work. Thank you so much for inner ethics and for carrying on holotropic breathwork. We are blessed, Kylia, to have your threads in this weaving. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and yours as well.
And Sarah Ellen, thank you for joining me in restoring herbal medicine to its rightful place as people's medicine. Till next week, everybody, dream blessings and good night.